Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. And thank you to our new, or latest new, or upgraded patrons. There's a lot of you this week as well. KV, Mike Charles, Paul Davison, James Cook, John Evans, Mark R., Mark McAvoy, Alistair Rose, Alex Waddell, or Waddle? Waddell? I'm sure he'll tell us. Hello, Alex.
I would say Waddell.
John M., Toby Roberts, Andrew Walker, Stephen Huxtable, many more besides. Thank you for either joining us or changing...
Tweaking.
Tweaking tiers, yes, a tier tweakage. It's incredibly helpful. You are the people, they are the people supporting us directly and getting access to our new sister show, Extra Message, our live streams, our unedited, uncensored versions, and much more besides. You can join them and support us for the same amount of money as buying us a beer once a month by going to patreon.com/UKTech. Thank you, patrons. Ian, actually, it's funny mentioning buyers a beer, partly because I don't actually drink.
Yeah, but I do.
I don't drink.
But I do.
True.
So they can buy me a beer.
But I was reminded of that helpful little comparison by a friend of mine, Ollie Mann, who produces the Modern Man podcast. On his episode this week, he read out an email that he'd had from a listener saying someone had stolen his idea of having a listener be a podcast ambassador in whichever country they lived in, but without realizing that Ollie nicked it from me after I told it to him in a pub a few years ago.
Right.
I, of course, stole it wholesale myself from the long-standing political tradition of employing diplomats to represent sovereign states, which I believe probably dates back a few hundred years, probably to the Middle Ages, credit where it's due.
Yes.
Anyway, I said to Ollie at the time that in return I was going to pinch his idea of saying supporting us can cost the same amount of money as buying one of us a beer once a month, and then I forgot. So thank you, Ollie, for reminding me to steal something of yours in return. And do, of course, listen to The Modern Man. Ollie's got a lovely voice, only matched in loveliness by his firm, warm hugs.
I don't think I've ever met Ollie.
He has firm, warm hugs. The days, Ian, of spending your precious lunch break standing in line for a sandwich are increasingly numbered, according to an Engadget write-up this week, as supermarket chain Sainsbury's launched the UK's first ever till-free grocery store. The blog wrote that the busy store in London's Holborn Circus. I was going to do a Holborn, but then I realised it's not Christmas and I'm not Santa, has been given a mobile-first makeover so customers can scan and pay for their goods via their smartphone, while staff previously chained to checkout areas are free to spend time helping customers on the shop floor. Now, Ian, we could sit here in our studio and talk about this, but instead we're going to hand over live to our roving reporter on the ground on his way to Sainsbury's to try this out for us in person. That person is me, Nate Langson. Nate, how's the weather over there in Holborn?
Yes, not bad, thanks. It's a bit muggy, and I'm hungry for some chocolate, which is what I'm going to go and buy from the Sainsbury's, which is now on my right. The windows are entirely covered with promotional material about how you can come in and pay with your phone. So I'm entering the store now. There's lots of people hanging around in orange T-shirts. Let me see. Okay, so I'm in the store now. It's a regular-looking store. I'm next to the sausages. Don't want those. I'm looking at some fish. Don't want those. Where's the chocolate? Where's all the unhealthy stuff? There it is. Hello, sir. Yes, I'm just documenting my experience. What shall we have? I'm going to have a dairy milk. And what else shall I buy, Ian? A ripple. Okay. I just place this on here and do the scanning, do I?
No, you need to have an app on your phone.
Right? I've got that ready, yeah. I just put that on here.
Yeah, yeah,
okay. Just be aware your voice is on my recording, if that's okay. Okay, so I take my app. Okay, I'm scanning the barcode on one product. It's just got a little spinning circle as it identifies. Okay, it's got that. I'm now scanning the dairy milk. taking a little longer than I expected. How long should this take?
It shouldn't take that long. It's sometimes your Wi-Fi or network provider internet.
Okay. It's scanned them. There we go. So yeah. Click close. I'm not scanning anymore. Check out with Apple Pay.
Yeah.
Double click to pay. And that's it.
And if you just press on the scan QR code.
To finish.
Just to finish. Yeah.
Okay, so there's this QR code on the exit.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah, in the bottom you will see done.
That's it. So they're scanning this little icon here on the side of the wall.
It generates.
It basically just says, I'm leaving.
Receipt and also it tells you that you're done.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Have a nice day, sir.
Thank you. Well, that's it. I'm done. I'm out. I've got my chocolate in my hand. It's all clear. A little bit of a faff in the first instance, but I presume that's just because it was the first time I was doing it. Back to you guys in the studio, where if you look under your desk, you'll see I've left a little surprise for you.
Ah, hang on. Let me look. There is a surprise. What's this? A Galaxy Ripple.
Oh, wonderful.
That's for you, I
believe.
Thank you. And somewhere else in here, a Dairy Milk. This will be for me. Thank you very much, Nate. That's incredibly kind.
No problem. Enjoy. You asked me to remind you to go to the doctor to have that thing checked out.
Yep, good. Thanks a lot. No need to talk about that. Thanks.
Cream. It's
right. Sorry about that.
Anything you want to talk about, Nate?
No. In the pub, maybe. Let's talk about the experience a little bit. In a sense, that whole process was fine. There was a little bit that I cut out of the in-situ recording just then, where I was trying to get the Wi-Fi, my 4G to work, and the Wi-Fi then in the store I tried as a fallback, and then the 4G started working again. The whole thing took a lot longer than it should have. Mm. Part of that was definitely my fault. But the other part, and this is something I did in advance of doing that recording, was I had to sign up for a Nectar card, because I don't have one. And that was a separate sign-up process to signing up to the app, the specific app that Sainsbury's has for this. It's two separate apps, two sign-ups, and then you link them together. Once you've sort of gone through the whole process of signing up and linking it and everything, then you go into the shop, and the experience was exactly as advertised. You can literally pull something, take something off the shelf, scan it with the barcode scanner on your phone like you heard me do, and then there's like a QR code on the window that you scan as you're leaving, and that just basically says, you know,
logs you out,
yeah,
and your build,
and that's it, and it's billed with Apple Pay, but you know, Google Android is supported as well, so that was all fine. It's just I can't get away from the feeling that as smooth as it all is, it benefits Sainsbury's a lot more than it benefits
it does.
You and me,
and you know why.
Well, I know several reasons why, but let's see if they tally up with what you were going to suggest.
Well, it's all just a massive surveillance operation, right?
It's in the script, I said it's something like a loyalty scheme on steroids or crack. Mm. Because you have to enable your camera. It asks you to enable GPS. When you sign up to the system, it says, do you want to receive offers for this, that, and the other? When my 4G didn't work and I had logged onto the shop Wi-Fi, it's O2 Wi-Fi, but the login page is Sainsbury's branded. It says the Holborn store name. So it's all very neatly tied up, and credit where it's due. They've done a good job of that.
Do you have to give it any more details to get into the Wi-Fi, or is it free with...
No, it's free, but there's a reg wall.
So you have to actually register for the Wi-Fi?
Unless you're already registered with BT O2 Wi-Fi, I presume.
Good grief.
But you shouldn't need to. That was only my fault for not having 4G. Anyone who's paying for their groceries with a mobile phone in the shop is going to have 4G.
Well, you say that, but not necessarily, because I've been in plenty of supermarkets because of the very nature of the... probably doesn't apply to this particular one, but plenty of sort of those metal-roofed supermarkets don't have very good 4G signal or you know, mobile signal. There's a couple I've been in that like that.
I mean, that's basically the problem I had, and I cut that out from the recording because nobody wants to hear 3 minutes of me farting around with 4G trying to get it to work.
Yeah.
Not even on the unedited version.
I feel like if Sainsbury's is going to offer a service like this, it needs to be planned better from that perspective, so that whilst it's reasonable to accept that people have 4G or 3G or whatever, it's going to be a quicker and better experience if they're on Sainsbury's Wi-Fi.
Well, let's just be super clear about this, because I don't want to sound like Sainsbury's has done a bad job with this for what it is. The app is very slick.
Yeah.
Once my 4G was working, the process was completely painless. Very, very straightforward, very fast, basically as advertised.
Yeah.
The problem I have with it is that it's, for me, it was no faster, or very, very little faster than using a self-service checkout with, you know, with contactless.
Yeah.
I would say once you get used to the process, it probably is marginally quicker because you don't have to wait for the self-service thing to finish speaking. And
well, and also, you won't, there's no queues, right?
There's no queues.
So that's, I mean, in a lot of Sainsbury or any supermarket, even for self-checkout, there is often a queue.
Yeah.
This gets rid of that. That's really nice.
It does just feel like a giant data grab. It is very much a very heightened loyalty scheme. You said surveillance. I don't think surveillance so much, but it really is all about data and knowing what you're buying, when you're buying it, where you're buying it.
Yeah.
No worse than Amazon, certainly.
No, but Amazon's a different kettle of fish. Supermarket shopping is much more, well, I don't want to say it's much more personal, but it could be. You know, there are all sorts of things that you buy in a supermarket that give a company a really specific profile about who you are. And that troubles me. I tell you what, I do understand why it is they do Nectar and the app registration separately, because Nectar is a separate company. It's not part of, say, it is a big part of Sainsbury's, but it is not exclusive to them.
Yes.
So I can sort of see that. I don't like the fact that you need to have Nectar. I don't think that should be a thing. Hmm. I just don't see the logic of that. Obviously, I understand why you have to have an app, but what I don't understand is why you need to register for it. Because if you're using Google Pay, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, whatever, there's actually no reason for that. You go through the process, you pay for the stuff. When it says you're clear, you walk out the door. I think if you really want to encourage people into your shop, getting rid of this stuff would be a big help, I think.
Camille M says in the chat room that he'd rather wait for Amazon Go.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the logic of that. I think that there is, Amazon does things a lot more conveniently. You know, just having the Amazon app is, I assume, enough for an Amazon Go store. Is that right? Or is there a specific app for it?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't even know if you need to have the app open.
It hasn't come to the UK, has it? So
we're veering off topic into things we don't know anything about. Let's get back onto things that we think we know about.
I might have to move this chocolate bar away because it's making me hungry.
It's for later, Chief.
Yes.
It's your reward.
Thank you.
Let us know any thoughts you have on this. Of course, if you've experienced Amazon Go, how does my experience compared to your own? hello@techpodcast.uk is where you can send that to. And if you want to come down and try the Sainsbury's, then it's in Holborn Circus. Every drone and model aircraft owner in the UK, Ian, could be charged £16.50 of the Queen's pence per year under plans by the aviation regulator, the BBC wrote this week. The Civil Aviation Authority is consulting on introducing a licence fee to cover the costs of operating the new drone registration scheme, according to the BEEB. And from November, drone owners would have to register their details on a database and drone flyers would complete a free online safety test. A final decision is expected by the regulator in July, and only those aged 18 or over would be able to register as the official drone owner. Now, there was an amusingly blunt and short blog post this week on the website of FPV UK, which is an industry body, represents drone users, and has its own membership plan, which we'll get to in a bit. And the blog said, all drone operators will be forced to register with the government by November 2019. The government has just opened a consultation on the £16.50 per annum proposed price. We think this is absolutely outrageous, brackets, parentheses, rather. It's almost as much as the FPV UK membership fee, and you get absolutely nothing to show for it, exclamation mark, close parentheses. Please be sure to tell the government what you think by completing this consultation. Now, I looked into FPV UK, and it lets people sign up £20 a year, lets members, it gets members £5 million of public liability insurance, which is no bad thing, and that's for all drone or RC model flying. You get discounts from some repair companies, practical courses, clubs and events and stuff like that. So it's fairly concerned the government forcing a charge of almost the same cost of their membership will potentially prevent people from wanting to pay for a second voluntary membership to something else, which I completely agree with.
I do completely agree with it. I think it absolutely will do exactly that.
I think it'll do exactly that. I think if this scheme needs to come in,
why not let FPV have a feed in so they ask for the government information? Have I stampled all over your point there?
No, you're just making a really good point I hadn't thought of, and I was going to pretend that I had thought of it.
Well, you've let the cat out of the bag, mate. But, you know, you see what I mean, right? I mean, I can. The government is obviously going to be wanting to collect data about people's drone serial numbers, you know, stuff like that, so that they've got some idea about where these drones are and things, and you know. So why not allow that the FPV to be a certified provider of that information? Obviously, there are certain headaches around that with GDPR, I'm sure. But it could be worked out. And it also seems like, unless the government's trying to make money out of this, which £20 a year doesn't sound like it's going to. I mean, there'll be more administration and setup costs than that will cover. It just sort of feels like the sort of thing where if they're trying to get to a point where they have drone registration and that kind of thing, it just feels like there are better ways of doing it.
But. So let me ask you this then, Ian, because I began thinking of along the similar lines to you, and I began agreeing with what FPV was saying. And then I started thinking about something I did last week, which was finally apply for my provisional driver's license. Ah. I'm going to learn to drive. And for those of you who find that surprising, you don't need to drive in London.
No, but I now don't live in London.
I don't live in London now, yeah. So I'm going to start learning to drive. And I had to pay for the privilege of registering and having a license sent through to me.
It's quite expensive, isn't it?
It was more than this, more than twice this cost. And there is a database and details and stuff and things that have to be maintained by the government. And I didn't object to paying a fee to get my license. I didn't. There's somebody sitting in a back office somewhere processing that, and
it's also a one-off fee.
Well, yes. Well, that's true. And this is per year.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe the solution really should be a one-off fee that you don't then have to repay like you do with a passport every 10 years or something.
Yeah, and I mean, I have very mixed feelings about this because. For a lot of drone people, they just want something to mess around with. I don't think they necessarily want to, you know, they want to go to the park and they want to fly it there. I don't think that registering that is really, it just feels completely over the top.
Yeah.
I think that where I'm very interested in licensing for drones is when you sort of hit the point where you'd like to do something with your footage, you know. So, for example, if I want to shoot a video, having a license for that enables me to fly my drone in places I wouldn't otherwise be able to would be appealing. So, and also a simplified sort of perhaps a little test that ensures that you understand safe drive flying and all that kind of stuff. I think that would be a really nice way for people who are interested in getting into sort of semi-professional droning to be able to do it without huge amounts of effort and expense. So I like that idea. I don't want to have every single man, woman and child who want to fly a drone on Saturday to be registered. It feels like overkill. But presumably there are some weight limits that would apply to this.
There are, but they're quite small. I don't have them to hand. We have talked about those before, but they're relatively small, I think. The question I would have about this is it feels a little bit like DRM for the skies in the sense that it's only going to negatively impact people with a legitimate interest in dronage.
Yes.
It's not like the people who
it's are... It's not going to stop anyone from being illegal.
Because the chat room was asking whether this is, you know, brought on by the airport,
Gatwick.
The Gatwick stuff and airports, which it's certainly been expedited by that, I would say. But the people who are flying drones over airports to try and, you know, have an anarchistic
That's
effect...
That's already illegal.
It's already illegal, and they're not going to register for that.
No.
Because if you're going to do a crimes, one does not register. I was also reading on the BBC a quote from Simon Dale. He is the boss of FVP, who says criminals aren't going to register, so the safe and compliant people are the ones listed on the database. So he's basically, in fact, he probably informed my erstwhile opinion.
Yeah,
but that's basically
absolutely true.
That's absolutely basically
true
the point,
of everything. You know, it's always the people who play by the rules that are the people who will be, you know, tracked and monitored. I would have a lot of sympathy with people who decided not to register. The chances of getting caught are probably pretty minimal. But again, I think it's a terrible shame that we're going to hamper technology by making rules that sort of stop people from doing perfectly legitimate things with drones. And of course, I'm worried about safety. No one wants to be at the park and have a drone fall out of the sky. I'm sure that's relatively rare. But at the same time, I feel like, from my personal experience, when I've flown drones, there is always this kind of sense, is someone going to get angry with me for this? I'm not trying to infringe anyone's privacy or anything. I'm not trying to make anyone's life unpleasant. Most of the time when I've flown drones, people have been like, oh, what's that? You know, really interested. And I've shown them and, you know, we've, you know, had nice conversations with it. And I think it's a shame to overburden things with legislation. I feel like the general public, as long as they're responsible, shouldn't be forced into a scheme like this. I think the place for this is for people who want to take it to the next level and who perhaps want to fly drones in places where recreationally it would be inappropriate.
Do you have a point or a counterpoint? Do let us know what either of those are. hello@techpodcast.uk. It's never perfect when Ian and I broadly agree on a topic, but maybe you disagree or have another view on this. Do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, the BBC has proposed making all of its commissioned content available on the iPlayer for at least a year. It's currently usually a month, I believe, isn't it? 30 days?
Yeah, something like that.
30 days or a month. Yeah. I think some stay longer, like documentaries and things.
But, it does depend. I think news stuff is generally left for a year or longer.
Yeah. And this story actually slipped under my radar last week, but I really wanted to highlight it after I found a copy of the BBC, the board's proposal to change this. And as a brief, I think it's worth probably putting a little brief reminder here for our overseas listeners. And the people in the UK, we pay a tax called the licence fee, and that goes to fund our state broadcaster, the BBC. And in return, the BBC has no ads on any of its UK broadcasts. The iPlayer is like Netflix because, you know, it's all the content that it makes, including live streams, and it's free to use and download from if you're paying the licence fee. But because it's regulated, the BBC can't do anything without approval that aims to protect competitors that don't benefit from the licence fee and instead rely on people paying or watching ads. So they're kind of in a rock and a hard place in some of these sorts of situations. And that's where this new proposal comes in, because the BBC wants to be able to compete better with things like Netflix, but it thinks it can't do that effectively without potentially harming local rivals, hence this consultation. Now, I've taken a few quotes out of this white paper. It was bloody long, but I went through the whole thing to try and find some of the most, you know, I think pertinent points here. And I found a few things. So the following, these are all direct quotes out of his. This is what the BBC says. We plan to make all BBC commissioned programmes available on BBC iPlayer until at least 12 months from when the final episode in the current series is first published on iPlayer. It said that in practice, this will mean some episodes are available slightly longer than others, but it will remove audience frustrations of individual episodes disappearing on different days. It argued that 12 months is an important minimum availability on all programmes to ensure that a significant range and depth of content is available at any one time, that typically only one full series would be available for each current title, and that there'd be a strong offer across the year, regardless of the rhythm of the linear schedule. And there's some other points in there, but I deem them to be much less interesting. So the BBC consulted competitors, again, this is all according to the white paper, competitors, production companies, industry bodies, cable providers, unions, other institutions, as well as the princely sum of 51 members of the public to find out how they'd feel about such a change. And the public response is quite interesting. In short, and this is what we can debate as well, I think, Ian. In short, there was a strong public support for these changes, that increasingly the availability of content that had been paid for with licence fee money could only be a benefit to viewers. And several respondents apparently described situations where they've been frustrated at having to try to start a series currently being broadcast or catch up on a previous series before a new series was transmitted, only to find that the first episode wasn't actually available anymore. You know, like maybe they're on series episode 5, but episode 1 is already gone because it was more than 30 days ago, so they can't actually start at the beginning. Like, that would be very frustrating. Like, imagine if, I don't know, Stranger Things on Netflix started with episode 3. Be a bit weird.
Yeah.
Or indeed most shows. There was also a line that amused me. It tickled me in a fun place, Ian. It was in the white paper. It said, where we received negative responses from members of the public, these were focused on other issues outside the scope of the public interest test, primarily quality of content and functionality of BBC iPlayer, including accessibility for expats outside the UK. I love the idea, and I think that there was about, it was in the teens, number of respondents who said something that was useless, because they said 30-something of the 50-something respondents were useful. It's great that you have a tiny number of people responding to an inquiry and a good third of them are whinging about something that they weren't asked about.
I mean, I know iPlayer does have issues with expats because I don't believe there's actually a legal way for you to have a service outside of the UK, you even if you're prepared to pay a licence fee to access it. I believe that because of the geo restrictions,
yes,
you're not allowed. I mean, of course, a VPN gets you around that very easily.
Unless the VPN's blocked, because Netflix, for example, blocks a lot of them now.
I'm writing an article at the moment about Netflix, BBC, and, well, about VPNs specifically, but one of my tests is exactly that. Can I stream the BBC from the UK?
But it's a moving goalpost, isn't it?
It is, and it does change, but I mean, I can only do what I can do. You know, you have to give people an idea. And most of the services work okay with iPlayer, a few notable exceptions, but yeah, so...
Well, we've steered slightly into,
as we always do,
off-topic street. I'm just going to navigate us back onto the main story avenue. Okay, we're back on the road now. There are some illuminating quotes here, and would you like to hear some of them?
I'd love to.
These come from the report. In fact, I've skipped ahead ever so slightly because I should have pointed out that these illuminating quotes came from Sky and Virgin.
Oh, well, there's a surprise.
Amongst others, who were perhaps predictably less keen on this idea. Virgin Media said that there was a potential material impact on TV platforms and in production and secondary rights markets like DVDs. Ian's head is tilted back. His tongue is out. He looks like he's having a medical problem, but he's actually just complaining silently. Sky said the proposals risked diverting audiences away from competitors, which could reduce the revenue and profitability of other video on demand services, reducing their willingness to invest, as in reducing Sky's willingness to invest, which would impact the production sector. And this is where the illuminating comments come in. They include, right now, despite its reputation for quality and the strength of its brand, the BBC iPlayer is not keeping up with audience expectations. And I should point out, these are BBC's quotes. These aren't Sky and Virgin's quotes. Yeah. These are quotes that the BBC itself has concluded. It continues, in today's media landscape, audiences do not understand why programmes drop off BBC iPlayer after 30 days. In 2014, our share of video on demand viewing was over 40% in the UK. If we do not adapt quickly to respond to audiences' new expectations, we expect our share of video on demand viewing to continue to decline over the next 5 years from around 15% today to 12% by 2024. And finally, they said, the BBC said, we find no evidence that our changes risk crowding out competition. And they did work with other agencies to gather this data and do this responses. So that's where that's not conjecture. It's based on some data.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that figure. 2014, BBC had 40% of the streaming market in the UK, and now says it admits it has 15%.
I don't agree. I fundamentally don't agree with Sky or Virgin on this whole competition thing. Here's why. Both of those platforms benefit from iPlayer because iPlayer appears on both. So Sky and Virgin Media are both made better and more attractive by the presence of BBC services. So they can wind their necks in on that. I don't agree with it. Sky produces a certain amount of content a year. It isn't a lot of homegrown. I mean, apart if you discount sport, there's a decent amount, and a lot of it's very good. Virgin isn't really in the TV production game anymore, is a platform. But I imagine most of its money doesn't really come from TV because it doesn't have channels, so to speak. So, its money's coming from different places. So I don't think either of those companies has a huge amount to complain about. I think if Netflix was to come along and go, actually, this does negatively impact us because a lot of BBC shows end up on Netflix. But the question has to be for the public who have paid for shows is what serves us better as a, in terms of the money we spent. And I think the answer to that is a strong iPlayer that offers people a good amount of content. Now, unfortunately, because of the whinging of companies like, I mean, perhaps not in this case Sky, but other companies over the years had complained quite extensively about the BBC's impact. the BBC sort of was told it, some years ago, that it had to, you know, offer a lot of its production to third parties. So there are third-party production companies now that make programmes for the BBC, you know, things like Endemol and, you know, others. So that was something that came about because of the competition issue. But it's also the reason that the BBC doesn't entirely own its own library. So deals have to be done, and it will take the BBC probably quite a long time to sort this out, because I imagine that the contracts that they do with, you know, companies like Endemol will be, we'll show this for 30 days after it's aired. They can re-air it and get another 30 days, but they will now then be taking that to a year. So will they be able to do air it once a year, say, and then in perpetuity have access to it on iPlayer? I suspect not.
Well, this is where I think BritBox comes in. And yes. John in the chat room asked about BritBox here. I think what is intended to ultimately happen is that you would have these on iPlayer for a year, and then they would be available on BritBox, which we've talked about.
Or Netflix, maybe.
Or both. But
or both. I think both is reasonable.
We've been told, we've talked about the fact that BritBox is in plans to come to Britain. Mm. So then you are essentially getting the content for a year on the iPlayer, then it disappears from the iPlayer, and then immediately, or continues, if it's already on there, appearing on BritBox, which would have a they've said it'll have a competitive price.
Yeah.
And then, so then it's all...
But BritBox is supposed to be more about archive. I mean, I'm not saying that they won't have modern shows.
There are modern shows on it. We talk about it being historical stuff, but there are modern shows.
Well, in terms of this, the BritBox service that we'll launch here is not the same as the one that exists for America, right?
It doesn't exist here yet, but it's meant to be fundamentally the same.
Right, okay, so that's interesting. But my understanding of it was that the idea was going to be that it would use the extensive archives of the BBC and ITV to offer a service, with the obvious advantage that you could add in other things that you would then repay for the rights for you know, the production companies that made them, etc. But of course, deals like this are complicated because some of those companies will have done deals with Netflix. So you might find that Spooks isn't available on BritBox because it's an exclusive to Amazon Prime or something like that. But
that's the problem we have now.
But it is a problem, and it will become increasingly a problem because we're going to be paying £150,000 a month for our subscription TV services.
Well, you're talking about subscription fatigue, and that's a topic that we're going to go into in another form in the future. KV in the chat room says fragmentation is being a problem, and that is definitely true. We've seen that happen time and time again, where something is exclusive for one platform for a while and then it disappears, and people get frustrated, particularly if it disappears halfway through watching a season, because they tend not to remove one season at a time. It's like it all just disappears, and then you're like, well, that's really frustrating, because if you signed up to watch something and then it's gone, that is frustrating. It's also the reason I still buy some content on iTunes, content that I know I want to watch and will continue to want to watch in future. I actually have most of that bought in my iTunes library for that exact reason.
But bear in mind that this is one of the reasons that Netflix is moving over quickly and with efficiency to its own original productions.
Yeah, it's the HBO model.
Yeah, I mean, the future for Netflix is not buying other people's content, because it's expensive, you're beholden to them, and then you can't make a brand out of something. I mean, Netflix is not quite there yet, because they sort of tend to cancel things quite quickly. I mean, you quite unusual for a Netflix show to get more than three seasons on the whole. You know, there's a big cancellation sort of thing around three seasons.
Orange is the New Black went on for longer, didn't it?
I know, well, there will always be exceptions. I think Stranger Things will perhaps last a bit longer because it's a phenomenon. Ozark, maybe, because that's one of their biggest shows. But anyway, you know, it's not a... This whole thing is complicated, but, you know, the BBC... In fact, the BBC doesn't have the luxury Netflix has, because Netflix could, if it wanted to, make 100% of the content that it puts on its platform. The BBC is not allowed to do that. So, you know, it will always be more of a struggle for the BBC with iPlayer or, you know, other services.
Let us know any thoughts you have on this, of course. hello@techpodcast.uk. What model would work for you? We welcome your thoughts. Or you can obviously tweet the matters at Text Message Pod. Well, let's jump into our mailbag, Ian. Randall wanted to comment on our discussion of a couple of weeks ago about the difference in average earnings for men and women in the UK technology industry. He says, "Hi, Nathan Ian. I'm an economist programmer and have been interested in this issue since my prior life as a research vice president in our central bank." He's in the US, and he says it's the Federal Reserve System. "I think it's fair to say that the 20% wage differential is something of an urban legend in the US, i.e. not exactly true, but used in political discourse as if it is. Once one adjusts for a few agnostic factors, the differential is essentially zero. The most important differentiating factor is not sex per se, but rather is the incidence and the length of time one is off one's career track. This factor applies equally to men and women, but women, in the US anyway, tend to interrupt their career track for family reasons more often and or for longer periods than men do. Both sexes have difficulty recovering from such hiatus events, but taking a snapshot of wages at a fixed point in time of people in seemingly similar job settings will always yield the appearance of the differential. I'm not saying this is good, just that folks in fast-moving tech and software engineering jobs are particularly likely to suffer from an untimely hiatus."
I mean, I can totally see what he's saying there. I think it would be interesting to maybe take a sampling point of a 25-year-old people. You know, if you made, I know that the rules obviously aren't like this, but if you said to companies, "You need to tell us the mean or median figures for everyone who's 25 in your company," I think you would get a better picture then about whether that's the case or not, because obviously you're going, for most people, pre having a child. I'm not saying obviously everyone, there are plenty of people that have children way younger than that, but you know, I completely see what he's saying, and it sounds like he's got far more experience in the field than I have, and I was happy to listen to experts.
Thank you, Randall, for the very informed email, and for joining us, a new listener. He did actually mention that he discovered us via one of my appearances on This Week in Tech.
This is why I love the fact that you do other media. You really get us out there. And
I do my best.
Yeah, and I don't have the time, unfortunately.
I like hanging out with Leo Laporte.
Yes,
it's.
I've never actually done a show with Leo, but I did do a show with Tom when he was at Twit.
Yes, now he's a lot of fun. I like Leo a lot. And you mentioned Tom, which is good, because it is Tom's voice which we are about to hear, because we keep you informed about our British landscape and context, but we're going to check in with Tom from Daily Tech News Show in the US and hear what's been happening in the wider world of technology this week.
We had quite a valuable week on DTNS. We talked with Jen Cutter about game developer burnout, why it's become worse, discussed all the announcements from F8 and how Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg emphasized privacy from other people, but not privacy from Facebook itself. We discussed how to use Slack responsibly so it doesn't make communication worse, evaluated the EFF's recommendations for fixing content moderation to strike a balance between your rights and stopping bad behavior, and Ashley Esqueda from CNET helps us tune our TVs so Game of Thrones doesn't look so dark. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, of course, to our patrons supporting us every week. And as we record, we're shortly about to publish episode 3 of Extra Message, mm-hmm. our new sister show patrons on our $3 tiers and above. That's coming in a few hours' time at the time we're recording, but hopefully by the time you hear this, that should be already on your feed. But if you're not a patron and would like to get our ad-free extended versions of each week's show, access Extra Message, of course, and our live streams, our unedited, uncensored versions, and a whole bunch more, join us, please, at patreon.com/UK Tech. Remember, it's like buying one of us a beer once a month. Thank you, Ollie Man, for letting me steal that.
Yes, and you can send us comments and suggestions and all sorts of anything at all you want. It's hello@techpodcast.uk. You can follow us on Twitter. It's @textmessagepod. And we like to post the latest news stories, so you can feel very well informed throughout the week. And thanks to everyone listening to us on our ad-supported free feed. The best way to give us a little bit of a boost is to leave us some feedback on iTunes and a star rating, 5 if you can manage it.
Thank you very much. KV put in the chat room, "Nice save." I have to say,
it was awful.
That was a very nice save.
It was not.
That was sort of like a goalkeeper slipping on the grass and accidentally kicking the ball away from the goal using his gentleman parts.
I always struggle with that, especially when I go off the script. But I also feel like people have heard that pre-pack enough times now that I need to sort of step it up a bit.
I should say as well that as of about 2 hours ago, we are now available on the Stitcher app.
Nice.
It probably is. I haven't actually checked that it works yet, but I had an email from their content partner people that says we are now on, been approved.
Well, it's good being on various things. I like the fact that we're on Spotify because it means that people can sort of dip in and out a little bit more easily.
Yeah.
So I quite like that fact that we all have to be a bit wary of what we subscribe to, because obviously we can't listen to everything. But I like the fact that, you know, you can give out a Spotify link now and people can just listen to one show if they're interested. I think it's a good thing, and hopefully some of those people will end up subscribing.
Yeah. Spotify, we're on Stitcher. Of course, we're on Acast. We're on the web.
Yeah.
We're in Apple
Podcasts.
You can
listen on both of our websites, can't you?
You can listen on both of our websites. What's our other website?
Well, I have a website.
Oh, your website.
And it has a podcast section.
Oh, yes.
And the latest episode is in that. Is fed into that.
And if I'm not mistaken, you link to us in your Forbes pieces, don't
you? I do, yes, I believe so, yeah.
God, we're everywhere. We're like, what are we like? What's everywhere?
Air.
I was going to say air.
Well, I mean, this is why we're friends.
Yeah, exactly. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.